Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now it's time to do the right thing.
We need more UNITY. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now it's time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
fighting. Right now, right now.
Now it's time to do the right thing. Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right.
Right now.
Going to do it right. This is Jamala Roger, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And I would like to say that the opinions expressed on BRHF are those of the program host, meaning me, and not necessarily the opinions of Harris Stowe State University or Black Radio Hall of Fame. And you all know I have plenty of opinions. So we are going to get down and dirty with this day's topic, and it's one that I have had an increasing interest in. I've always had an interest in, but it has gone through some changes, and we're going to talk about that today with our guest. We have today with us Stephanie Pender Amaker, and she is the Chief Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer at McLean Hospital. She has done 25 years of work around college student mental health, and we know we need the on the campuses with all that's going on both outside and inside the campus. She's got a host of other things that she's involved in, but we also have her colleague Lauren Wadsworth, and she is a board certified licensed clinical psychologist, and you know she's done some work around diversity, equity, and inclusion as well. So they together wrote a book called Did That Just Happen? And, you know, there's many ways that you can put some tones on that. You could say, did that just happen? Did that just happen? So we get ready to get down. That's the name of the book, and it is a fascinating book. But I want to first start with how you all came together, because obviously you have done work separate and apart from collaborations, and it's a very stellar approach, because I really appreciated you all giving a shout out to the Organization for Black Struggle as in terms of our work around racial justice. And one of the things I thought about reading that book is like, you have all this work that you do, and then all of a sudden, it's almost like the mythical person going up the mountain with the boulder. And, and then you get to that plateau and say, phew, now we can rest. Now we can like enjoy and give yourself a pat on the back. And then there are the forces of evil, the forces of reaction, the forces of oppression waiting there. And then they give that boulder a good kick. So how did you all continue this work, and how did you meet? And then let's talk about how and why you decided to write that book.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Jamala. And thank you for the different ways that you use the inflections to say the title, because I think it's been said probably with all of those tones and then some. And we just want to thank you so much for having us. It's really an honor to be with you and your audience. Thank you for having us on Voices from the Battlefield. So how did we meet? We met while we were both working in the same hospital as an academic medical center, and I was assigned as one of Lauren's clinical supervisors. We were matched together, essentially, and we discovered through this match and this relationship that although we were at two really different stages of our careers, I was a clinical program director, Lauren was a psychology pre-doctoral intern, and although we both possess like different intersecting social cultural identities for reference, we both identify as women. I'm Black, Lauren's white, I'm straight, Lauren is queer. What we discovered is that we both had these recurring, challenging workplace experiences related to our identities. Things like, well, things we wrote about in the book, like pioneerism, mm-hmm. and being the anointed DEI expert, navigating microaggressions, something we re-termed as identity-related aggressions, and so on. These shared experiences. And so over time with, I should say, it's really important to say this, over time and with a lot of trust building between us, we decided to share what we were learning about these experiences and what we were processing together. And we decided to do the sharing in like a more intentional, and for us, what we hoped would be a more like empowering way. And we chose two pathways for doing that. One pathway was we launched our own DEI consulting company. We did that in 2018. And then almost about the same time, committed to writing Did That Just Happen, which we went on to publish in 2021. And that's how we met.
Very interesting.
And I can share.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to remind people, or in case I didn't say it, is that you all are both medical doctors in the field of, you know, psychology and psychiatry, right? So if you came together in an academic setting, but you still have a different set of credentials. So go ahead, Lauren.
Oh, I was just going to say that we were inspired to write the book partially to share what, as Stephanie was saying, our examples with of how we navigated these stressors and dynamics in the workplace with other people, but also to have a way to process and share and train that was maybe a bit safer than doing so in the organization we were working in. Not to say it was unsafe, but just to say that anytime you do this work, DEI work, you are often met, or I'd say you're always met with some level of defensiveness or projection, and that can be really draining. As you alluded to, Jamala, the work can be exhausting. So having a different venue to do that by writing the book together, we were able to funnel all of our thoughts and experiences and strategies into a format that didn't get defensive or project back onto us, and that was really energizing and freeing in a way. It was also happening, we were writing a lot of this during the initial lockdowns of the COVID pandemic, and it offered us a way to do the work while the world was on hold, and in the way of working together in person, but also having a lot of events happening in the media related to racism, and doing something while those were happening felt inspiring and empowering for us, and we were happy to have a way to do that.
So just in terms of the book, was, and this is just a follow-up question, was there a research project, and then you realized, man, these stories are so poignant, so juicy, we got to do something with them?
It was actually more of a response to being... Each time we entered the workplace, we had the experience individually as being donned or labeled the diversity expert.
Mm.
And when you're labeled the diversity expert at work, I'm not sure if you've had this experience, Jamala, but when we have had this experience, people say, oh my gosh, you're queer? Okay, you must be the expert on all things LGBTQ.
Mm-hmm.
Everything about trans folks and teens and surgeries and things that I have no experience with or any formal training in, but just, you know, experience with friends. So it didn't feel appropriate in many cases how that was generalized. But then it was followed with requests for trainings. Can you train the whole organization or your team on X, Y, and Z? And in my position as a trainee, that felt dangerous because I was going to be telling people things they didn't want to hear or that they mm-hmm. should be doing things differently. So having, after having a lot of experiences of that not going so well, the idea of writing the book came as a way to share this learning in a different format.
Mm-hmm.
And our hope was that folks in our position, folks that were pioneers, could say, they could read this book and then slip it under the door of their boss that might not be safe for them to speak to, but maybe anonymously say the things that they aren't safe to say. And we were hoping to do that for people. suffer with them.
And I'm going to ask you to define, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And when we say DEI, that's what we're talking about. It's just like we don't want to have to keep saying it over and over again. But what for me, in the early stages of the term and the actual work, I actually believed in it. And then I started to see that it was being perverted for, you know, obvious reasons, because nobody was really going to be serious about equity and inclusion. And so what some of us began to notice is, like, that was a puff job. And so if you had a situation at your corporation, your company, or at the on the campus, you go get somebody and you say, hey, help us fix this for now. But there was never a long-term commitment to dealing with the root causes of some of those the issues that were bubbling up. And so we just, you know, some of us just got dismissive about, you know, diversity, and it just overused. But then something happened, and we believe, and I think you all do too, that the world changed after George Floyd. And so then there was this, again, more attention being paid to DEI, and the folks who were taking on those roles, they were starting to take it seriously. And they were starting to, like, push on the inside for policy changes, for, you know, behavior changes. And then we had the backlash. And all of a sudden, DEI is a danger to national security. So it's just the way that it evolved, and it's been morphing. And so now, once again, I'm a big champion of it, because the people that I saw taking the hits in very real ways were actually very serious about the commitment to diversity, equity, inclusion, particularly the equity part. I don't know if you all heard about one of our colleagues in the academic field in Lincoln University committed suicide just based on the book. So this thing has gotten pretty serious. And so your definition, can share with the audience what it is, and why do you think it's under such attack now?
So, well, first, just like the basic part, like the first part of your question, like define diversity and inclusion, I'll answer it in two parts. I'll say, like, the first part, you know, just for the purpose of, like, a definition, like, in theory, just on the D and I, like, in theory, diversity and inclusion reference, you know, the practice of including or involving people from a broad range of different sociocultural backgrounds and identities. And in our work, we often use a specific framework. It was developed by another psychologist, Dr. Pamela Hayes. It's her addressing identities model. And we rely on that frequently because we really like the model as a, like, a way of, like, further defining what we mean when we talk about diversity and inclusion. And Dr. Hayes is addressing identities model. It's both like a framework, but it's also an acronym, right? So the acronym, and you may be really familiar with this framework, but the acronym is addressing, probably the world's longest acronym. And the acronym part of it directs us to about a dozen different aspects of identity that are important to consider. So if you're following the acronym, then A is for age, and then you've got the D's for diagnoses and disabilities, ethnicities, religion, race, the things that will typically easily come to mind when you're thinking about diversity, right? But the acronym reminds us, oh, but there's also, like, sexual orientation, indigenous heritage, national origin, social economic status, gender and gender expression. So we love that as a way of sort of further defining what it is that we mean by diversity, because we don't want people to, like, it's easy to be dismissive and to take shortcuts, right? And to pigeonhole. And we've seen that, right? And that's where a lot of the backlash has come as well. So we just want to be really clear from the outset that when we're talking about diversity, we're talking about all of it. Right? So that's the acronym. And then the framework itself offers additional guidelines for helping us to understand, you know, based upon these aspects of identity, who might not be so readily seen and heard. And then that's where we need to be especially mindful and intentional about the practice of inclusivity. And then I'd say to the additional part, so that's kind of the theory part. In practice, I think you referenced this, Jamal, I think what people have been finding, and it's, you know, clearer than ever, is that diversity and equity can't stand alone, right? They're mm-hmm. incomplete. Mm-hmm. And so the body of work has been evolving, and we know now that it requires us to include additional, very important constructs like equity, like belonging. We're seeing the addition of accessibility, for example. And I think that evolution is really important because it reflects that, you know, we're still figuring this out. It is not static. We know it's a moving target, and that there's still a lot of work to be done. And you reference another, like, underline, we'll probably use this word a dozen times today, another important feature of it, and that's the sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
An important feature as well. And there was a second part, the second part to your question.
No, it was mainly
what
the definition was, in my view of it, that has changed over the last probably 25 years.
Because
you know, at one point, when you talk about a diversion officer, you know, that person was going to plan the annual Black History Month program or the Women's History. But now these DEI officers, they want to look at the policies of a company. They want to look at the pay scale of a company. They are doing deeper dives to look at where's the equity. You might have diversion at least, you know, superficially, but where's the equity? So when you say both of them go together, that you can't have one without the other, that's exactly the truth. And maybe that's the power that some of these reactionary forces are responding to.
Yes.
So one of the things in the book that really, it didn't tickle me, but I thought about some other examples that I have been involved in. And this is this notion of going to the workplace, and I think it was you, Lauren, that talked about sometimes it's not safe. And I remember on social media I read this thing where it says, don't take your whole self to work if you're a person of color or if you are one of those marginalized identities, because it's dangerous. So you don't go there sharing and opening up because you're going to get hurt and it's unsafe. So this was an example that you all had in the book of a African woman who was trying to do her best to assimilate where she was. And one of the things that I took some amount of humor is the way that she shortened up her name for the sake of white people being able to relate to her. And I see that happening so much, not just with Africans, but with Southeast Asians, with, mm-hmm. you know, Arab names, you know, to make it easy for them, you give a part of your identity, including your namesake, which is important in most, particularly indigenous communities. And so I thought, yeah, I see that happening all the time. They want to shorten it up so that you sound like a white person, at least the name, and just make it comfortable for them. Because if they have to say Abdullah, you know, instead of Do or Abby, you know, it's like, no, I'm not going there. So it's just so many examples in the book about how it shows up and how the person who has to endure what they feel. But I think when you start looking at, okay, how do you get past this? And you talked about the sustainability. How do you all look at the sustainability? Because, you know, at one point I did some of this work, and I realized mm-hmm. people were not sincere about it, and they only wanted it for short-term things to, you know, to say, check off that box and say we had somebody come in and give us a training. So if there's no mm-hmm. long-term commitment, you know, I'm out of there. But
mm-hmm.
at some point, people do need the training. People do need to understand how their actions, behaviors, are impacting other people in the office or in the workspace, even if those identities are not clearly known or embraced, you have to know that if you're in a room of a bunch of people, there's all kinds of identities there that you need to be aware of. So how do you navigate that part?
Yeah, I think that's something that you're speaking to is one of the, you've talked a lot about the timelines and how things have changed over the history of us talking about identity in the workplace or in community. And one of the things that's really shifted is a move away from this idea of cultural competence, that people just need to learn these five skills or these five facts about queer people or black people, and then they become culturally competent and they're done, right? They've checked the box. We did the workshop. We got the DEI officer and we celebrated, we sent an email celebrating each of the months of the year. And we've found, as you've alluded to, that that is not effective. The one and done workshop does not have any long-term significant effects on behavior change. And in fact, the idea that people are walking, or the experience of people, especially white people, walking around saying, I did the diversity training, I'm all good, I'm culturally competent, can be even more harmful than not having done it at all. It's, you know, folks thinking that they're done learning and then engaging in microaggressions and harming people, and that might be done at the outset of a relationship, or someone might start a relationship with that person thinking they're safe and then be harmed even worse because of that. And we're shifting towards using the term cultural humility instead, which was developed by Dr. Turbulon, who is a black doctor in the field, who cultural humility encourages us to see this learning as something that we're always working towards. It's something on the horizon. We will never get there. It is a journey, not a destination. And when we see cultures or workplaces holding that culturally humble lens, saying, we're never going to be done learning. We're always going to make mistakes. We aim to learn how to heal from those mistakes effectively and efficiently and to make less mistakes in the future. But we are always trying to engage in this process of learning and being humble in that learning. When folks have that approach, they tend to invest more in diversity trainings, do so in a way that is happening throughout time, and folks there know that it's going to keep happening. And that can do so much to increasing the sustainability of being a person with one or more marginalized identities in the workplace.
When I think about also like how this construct, this idea of cultural humility that Lauren just described versus that one and done sort of culturally competent model moving toward that, it's really interesting how like cultural humility has, you know, it's become like more in vogue. I would say today I was walking through, I was on University of Penn's campus a couple of months ago, walking through the medical center, and they had a whole campaign and posters up everywhere in the cafeteria about cultural humility. I thought, oh, isn't this interesting? And as Lauren mentioned, cultural humility, it was founded by two black women physicians, Melanie Turbulon and Jan Marie Garcia. But when the term was founded, like in 1998, it was a long time ago, when they published the first article, they couldn't even get it published. You know, and now it is really like a hallmark of like something that we think about automatically when you ask Jamala, like, well, what comes to mind when you talk about sustainability? And that's at the foundation. It's at the core. It's that focus on the tenets of cultural humility versus the competency one and done. You know, I took that workshop, read that book, I'm done, I'm good now.
I'm an expert.
And the danger of that, right, I'm an expert. And then, so I was thinking about another sort of, so that's like a foundational piece, and we're really big on this notion of sustainability, reflecting a lot of what you were saying earlier, like Jamal, about the interest, how it peaked, and then it waned, and then we're going through this experience of backlash, and fatigue and so on and so forth. But we think like the sustainability part is critical. The title of our book is Did That Just Happen Beyond Diversity, Creating Sustainable and Inclusive Organizations. So if we had to add another word to the diversity inclusion, we'd add like sustainability. Like it has to be, the work has to be prioritized and there has to be an ongoing commitment. So that the thrust is programmatic, right? Like moving away from, as Lauren mentioned, that one and done model here, like the disappearing act, we refer to it like we're here today, but you know, we're gone tomorrow. Let me tell you, there's nothing more demoralizing than engaging communities that have been historically underserved than providing a focus and increased resources only to disappear in the following year, right? That's even more painful in the long run. So the sustainability part is just critical. A phrase that often comes to mind is probably, you're probably very familiar with this. It's from journalism. It's the expression like, this story has legs. Right, which means that a story is going to continue for a long time, right? It's not going to show up on the evening news and then disappear into thin air. We're going to be hearing about this thing for a while. That's what you want for every bit of DE&I programming. You want to think at the outset, if we do this thing, how are we going to sustain it over time? What are we going to do now to ensure that it's still in place in a year, in 2 years, in 3 years? And I think that's an important like part of making, you know, the work persist and have legs over time.
And I'm thinking about, you know, corporations like the NBA, the NFL, who put a ton of money into a campaign. And a lot of it, as far as I was concerned, is sloganeering. I mean, athletes got to wear, you know, little, you know, Black Lives Matter on their t-shirt or whatever. And I'm thinking, okay, all of this is very cosmetic. But visually people are seeing something. But when I look at, for example, what it looks like on the inside and, you know, how many women coaches do you have? How many Black coaches? Who's in that front office and what are they getting paid? And, you know, what kinds of monies are you, contributing to communities that, where you have teams? So, you know, somebody has to be mapping that out, as you said, like 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 20 years.
Yes.
What is it going to look like? Because when I see that, something is going on without the terminology, then you know that is now organic to those organizations. So you all come from a medical background, and I'm, you know, when I think about psychology and psychiatry, and I think about our mental health in this country, period, but particularly for African Americans, and I'm wondering, because of your training and background in mental health, what do you see as the consequences when we don't observe and protect and respect diversity and equity?
Oh man, the consequences are massive and they're heartbreaking. And we've all seen this on a personal level, I'm sure. But I mean, in short, it's turnover. It's people having to leave their jobs because it feels so unsafe, or it is so unsafe, where they've received, you know, been on the other end of the thousandth microaggression, and it's just too much to bear. There isn't the ability to build trust or feel seen or appreciated as an individual. Maybe that person has been bound to the diversity expert role again, and they would rather be seen for their skills in math or whatever their expertise is. We lose the ability to work with what we know is a more effective team. When we have more diversity across the team, the bottom line for the business is actually better. There are financial benefits to be made. If people need that to be the motivation, okay. But I think that we think that the social benefits are even greater, that we lose the ability to have relationships across difference, which I think has a downstream effect of that issue you were mentioning earlier, Jamala, about diverse DE&I work being under attack. If we don't know people that are different from us, how are we supposed to contradict the news that tells us we should fear people that are different from us?
Mm.
So I think there are financial, social, and political ramifications of not attending to it.
Yeah, I like the way that you said that, Lauren. If I would sum it up, in just in the first word that comes to mind is just loss. Capital L-O-S-S. Like, if you're not prepared to really sort of embrace and promote diversity, equity, and inclusion, then be prepared to lose. And you're going to lose often, and you're going to lose a lot. You're going to lose, as Lauren said, diverse talent. You may be effective in the short term in recruiting diverse talent because we've seen lots of industries make a commitment, you know, to increasing what we refer to as diversity by the numbers. But if you don't attend to the equity and the inclusion, then you're not going to retain diverse talent. So there's the loss of the diverse talent. Be prepared to lose relevance of your organization. Be prepared to lose your reputation, right? Another consequence. Be prepared to lose the value proposition. And bottom line, be prepared to lose money.
Mm. Which I think they are always concerned about, right?
As Lauren said, if that's what that, like, you know, be prepared because the loss is coming and it's going to come in a lot of shapes and sizes.
But, you know, I think the loss, when I think about losses, I also deal with young people, and when you think about the number of barriers based on being poor, based on being queer, based on being black, based on all of those come with layers of obstacles and restrictions. And what would the world look like if all of those were lifted or eliminated? And that's the message that I bring to people about our young folks. We want to look at them as liabilities. Well, yeah, based on what we've created for them, there's not very many support mechanisms in place or a lot of nurturing going on, particularly for black males. So what would this country be like if all of us could, you know, attain our ultimate potential and be our highest beings? And that's the kind of society that I think we are all shooting for. And so you all have done a lot of work in these institutions, and you know, for you, Stephanie, you're part of your work has been at Harvard University, you know, the bastion of, you know, white patriarchy and everything else. What does it look like to try to turn that big ship around in terms of diversity and equity? And I know they've done some stuff with black students in terms of free scholarships and that kind of thing. But often what I hear from black students who are there is, like, the climate and the culture is still not changed. Yes, they got a free ride, but now they got a whole set of obstacles, cultural obstacles to navigate through. So mental health-wise, you all are at these institutions. What is it looking like to make some fundamental, substantive changes there that's going to benefit everybody who's got to go through those portals?
I can say, like, in terms of, like, when you think about college student mental health, you know, more broadly, and that's an area, actually, Lauren also still works as a senior advisor to my institution. I'm the Chief Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer, and Lauren's one of our senior advisors. But we both worked in college student mental health when we were at the same institution for a while. And a lot of our work was in specifically around this issue. And we provide, like, clinical services, so, like, treatment, you know, innovative treatments with college students. We did research, but a big part of our work as we developed our program was outreach to the community. And so rather than, like, sit in our hospital and sort of invite and wait for college students and their parents and their families to find their way to us, we went out to the colleges and universities, and we visited there. We built partnerships and relationships, and we partnered with a lot of schools and develop this consultation model, like in college student mental health program, just to, like, as we were building trust together, places would begin connecting with us and with a consultation question. And the question that we got at the beginning, the questions were all over the map, everything from policy to, I mean, just all kinds of things. But in the last 10 years, the number one consultation question that we've gotten from colleges and universities around the country has been, how do you redesign and reshape the resources, the mental health resources on campus, so that they fit the needs of an increasingly diverse student body? Period.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the question. And what ignited that whole shift, it didn't happen sort of by accident or just, because of, how the stars were aligned. What happened was that students really pushed that to happen. They did it in the academic year 2015-2016, primarily when students of color nationally were protesting on college campuses, and we've seen these protests, right, over the year, for decades and decades on campus, right?
Yes.
So what was unique in 2015 was that for the first time in the history, students had on their list of demands mental health needs.
Mm.
So yes, we want to see more faculty who look like us.
Mm-hmm.
We want to have better housing situations. We want to have improved financial aid. But for the first time, we want someone to really attend to the mental health needs of us as students of color. And the models that you have in place aren't working for us.
Mm-hmm.
So that was like a really watershed. So I say that to say historically it was really students that pushed that, that really ignited that change. And the way that it played out for us through our hospital's consulting services, that suddenly that was the question that colleges were paying us to have them answer. Well, how do we do this?
Mm-hmm.
How do we? And so we've got a lot of different strategies, and there isn't a single approach, but one sort of leading idea is that we work with organizations to become much more, practitioners to become much more culturally informed. An expression, something that we hear a lot. I get this a lot. Lauren gets it. Well, I'll say I get this a lot as a black woman in psychology when I come into an institution of higher education. Even though really my leading expertise is in college student mental health, people will often look to me and say, well, you're the diversity expert. You tell us how to do this and how to, and what my answer to that is, yeah, I think all practitioners need to be diversity experts. Yeah, my work is culturally informed and multiculturally informed. And it's not a matter of whether I am or I am not, but it's why don't we all have this multicultural expertise? We all need it. Not just people who identify as holding underrepresented or minoritized identities, but everyone who's providing service. They have to develop those skills and those strategies. So that's a big thrust of the work that we do. We work with organizations, counseling centers on campuses, but also places outside of counseling centers, because what we know from students whose identities are underrepresented on campus is that they don't always feel welcome in the places, in the spaces that we have set up for them to come and seek services. So we have to redesign those services. And in many cases, we have to take those services to the places where students are comfortable gathering. Maybe it's in the Black Student Union, or Multi-Ethnic Student Affairs, or in the International Student Center, or in the LGBTQ office. But sometimes we have to step out of, the traditional models and meet students where they are. And so that's a big sort of thrust or some kind of recurring theme in how we are working to have, mental health services and resources align more effectively with increasingly diverse students on campuses.
Yeah.
I'd say that was a really long answer.
No, that was a good answer. It was a thorough answer. And it was interesting to know that where it came from. So, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about the first time that I experienced a peer, a young peer, committing suicide was in college, and that was 1968. I thought that was foreign to young people because I had a happy, you know, childhood, and I'm going to college first time, you know, I'm committing suicide. So that kind of thing was just unheard of back then. But now we've seen, you know, cases of rape, cases of, you know, drug abuse, suicides on campuses, because that stuff doesn't stay out in the community. People bring that stuff with them wherever they go. So I think it's imperative that those services are on campuses and that they are accessible. The stigma is being, you know, removed so that they can get what they need, because I can't think of any place more stressful than college in this day and age, because you've done so much to get there and so much is being required of you. And then if you're in a hostile environment, now there's some other issues you got to work. It's not just, you know, you put your head down in the books. It's all these other things you have to deal with. So to hear that some of those things are going on the campuses, it, to me, is encouraging.
Yeah, thank you for that. A lot of our work also, when we sort of develop different workshops and like training modules that we bring to campuses, I'm thinking, Lauren, of some of the modules that we brought, we sort of offer them in spaces, not always where you'd expect to have them, right? Like in counseling centers. Of course, we want counseling center services that have special training in this area, but you know, there have been some campuses that invited us in to develop trainings and workshops for, you know, their residence advisors, right? These aren't mental health professionals. They're not, like, trained clinicians, but they're often, to your point, Jamala, on the front line, like the first who might notice that a student in their midst who's living in the dorm, in the residence hall, may be struggling. Or maybe, you know, showing signs of depression and so forth. So we develop a lot of training to help empower those folks who are going to first come into contact with students, and also to help faculty, because faculty can be often first to recognize. And we've done a lot of work nationally to try to sort of help faculty to understand they don't have to be mental health providers to be able to recognize when a student is struggling and to have, you know, like a prepared way of supporting and connecting that student to the services and supports that they need.
If you're just joining us, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we have two, I'm not going to say DEI experts, we have two advocates, Dr. Lauren Wadsworth and Dr. Stephanie Pender-Amaker, and we've been having a very down-to-earth discussion. There's not been a lot of clinical, you know, terms being used. We're just getting down with the lay people so you all understand what's going on in the world around you. And if you are parents that are about to send your kids off to college, some of these services you probably need to ask before you go as part of the tour to say, what's your mental health services like? Because I'm telling you, when you're on those campuses isolated, you don't always want to call mom and dad because they sent you there with high expectations, and now you're struggling just to get up in the morning. So I just, one of the things I thought about you all is I know you can't call out anybody that you work with that's not doing well around the DEI. That's for people like me. But are there any examples?
That's your job.
Yeah, that's my job.
And
I love doing that. But are there any examples of somebody doing it right? Like they may not have it all the pieces together, but they've got the commitment and they have a plan and they're working that plan. Anybody you're working with that's at that level?
We've got lots of examples. I'm happy to see
you. Good.
And I'll say that, like, one of the really, like, I think inspiring, just really one of the unexpected, Lord and I, we didn't know, like, what to expect when we both did that just happen and put it out in the world. We certainly didn't expect to still be giving book talks and being invited to speak about the book 3 years. It's been 3 years since we published the book.
Yeah, that was 2021, right?
So we didn't see any of this, but I think something that's just been incredibly, like, humbling and inspiring, motivating for us has been an opportunity to engage with so many different industries and to see how they're doing the work, right? How they're engaged. Like, we learn new things all the time. They invite us to come and do a workshop or to talk about the book, and then we learn something new about how they're, like, the model that they have on their campus. So there are a few that I just want to mention quickly. The first is a university, because you mentioned Harvard. Oh, I'll really just shout out, in the positive, a shout out to Harvard University's athletic department. They happen to have the largest athletic, Division I athletic department in the country. They have 42 teams.
Oh, wow.
Which a lot of people don't realize they are the largest athletic department, but they did something pretty unique, and I think pretty unique for an athletic department. They selected our book as their, like, our reading book for the entire athletic department, so all of the staff in this huge department, and they worked with us to figure out, like, when should we give the book to staff. We suggested, and they did. We said, don't do it, like, in the middle of the year, especially in the athletic department. People are tired, they're burned out. We suggest, why don't you gift it to them over the summer as, like, a summer reading? Well, they took it to the next level. They did that. They gifted the book over the summer. They set up summer reading groups for them, you know, opt-in, optional, which was, like, a wonderful model. And then in the fall, when everyone came back and they were, you know, energized and refreshed, then they invited us to give, like, a workshop. And that particular workshop they wanted was on how to address microaggressions, what we refer to as identity-related aggressions, more effectively. How do you identify them, get better at, a lot of our work is very, I don't think we've said this yet, but one of the things that was really important to us in writing this was to make the work very practical, like skills-based and accessible. We want people to be able to pick it up and just get it and be able to feel empowered, like, oh, my gosh, I can actually do this. Like, I can learn these skills. Or to read the vignettes and say, oh, yeah, I've experienced that, or I've done that, or I've said that thing. Not just been on the receiving end, but I've actually done some of those things. And now, what can I do about it? And we want it to be, like we said, practical and accessible. As you were saying, you know, just kind of breaking it down, like making it plain, right? So that was one model. We really shout out their department for doing that, because what they don't know. So it's an example of what I would say, like, an intervention that has legs. Because they made that investment. They had us come back, and they supported the investment during the summer through their book groups, and then they invited us back to do the workshop. What they don't know is that then a number of individual teams, just on their own, which then assigned the book to their students, to their teams, to their student athletes, and then said, hey, would you come to our locker room and just give a talk or sign a book? Or, you know, like, so that's something that has legs. And I'm not saying it doesn't have to be our book, right? You can do this with, you know, with any special reading that you want. But that was a like an investment that was really programmatic. And now it's been 2 years, we're still being, it's still happening. Like, it's still making its way from team to team. So that's one example of a model that we love. Just quickly, another model is, got a shout out, Kennesaw State University. They've got this inclusive leadership model that's fantastic, where they invite members to sort of join, like, this sort of, like, a learning group, right? Like you would call a learning cohort. They're from all over the university, so all different disciplines, right? You know, people from the math department, English, history, African-American studies, administration, athletics, this group of really diverse professionals, and they bring them together for an entire year of being together and learning how to, like, develop the skills and strategies to lead at the university, but with the foundation of inclusivity and valuing diversity and equity. And it's phenomenal.
Hmm.
Wow. I should pause because I feel like I haven't taken a breath. I know Lauren, you have some examples.
I was going to say, well said. The only thing that I'll add is that we've also worked with orgs who wanted to really be thoughtful before starting trainings with us to do a needs assessment, which we customize for each org that we work with, to ask the members of that organization what they think they need in an anonymous format that's data-driven, and we can assess the behavioral changes that need to happen before and after trainings to see if they had any impact. And when we do that work, usually when we're doing the needs assessment and report the results, we do so with the whole organization at once, so it's not filtered through leadership, which we think is a great way to build trust, to drive the work through the needs of the community at all levels. And also we encourage folks to, before launching in, after getting the results, to commit to a certain number of trainings, again, with us or with others. Sometimes we refer to other trainers, but the point being that they're committing to a series of trainings that are done over the course of years, so it's not the one and done, so that when folks start to engage in the trainings, they know this isn't the last one. They know there's going to be another one in 6 months, and there's transparency about that process.
I'm still back here at the 42 teams. Wow. Who knew?
That's a surprise for a lot of people, largest in the country.
But again, I think starting at the team level is probably a good damn idea, because you're not trying to take on the whole university. Even though 42 teams is pretty big, but it's still a manageable department that you could have. You could actually see some impact. You could see some progress. You could see some change. So, yeah, those were some good examples. And it, again, it's very encouraging, because while Lauren was talking, I was wondering if sometimes you all get used as the hammer, like, okay, y'all didn't do this. We're going to call those diversity people in y'all.
Does that happen? That's a good question. Oh, my goodness. You couldn't have said that any better. We walk into that. When that has happened, we know it, because that's exactly the kind of reception we get. And then we have to say, wait, let's just hold it a minute. What's going on here? And kind of, like start fresh, because that's something that's not a helpful way to begin. So you think about, like, what are some negative features? And then remember, like, an important positive feature that Lauren just mentioned is, something we get often is, like, when there hasn't been sustainability, when any sort of outsider, like, and that's what a consultant is, right? You're kind of being invited from the outside to come in, which is already a scary thing,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
But, you know, it's for, like, we get that reaction of, like, well, who are you, and why should we talk to you, and why do we even bother? Because, you know what, we did this 3 years ago, and nothing was sustained. So, again, it's like that long-term impact, the negative consequences of not putting, like, standing up a sustainable process to begin with, which is why what Lauren said is so important, what we often recommend, you know, whether it's with us or with someone else, like, whatever you do, map out a plan that can show, that can commit to your organization that we're in this and we're staying in this. You know, this isn't like we're going to, you know, invest $100,000 in an ad campaign for fancy t-shirts and have no substance to back it up. This is the substance to back it up. And this is how we're going to roll it out over the course of the months and the years. And by the way, we're also going to evaluate, is it working? And what's working and what's not working and what isn't working, we're going to course correct. And we're going to be honest and transparent about that. We're going to share the data with everyone in real time. So I think that's another really important, I'm glad you mentioned it, Lauren, like a sort of a positive, what I refer to as a positive feature for organizations that are doing it, doing the work sort of effectively and well. It includes an evaluation component so that you're not just guessing about, oh, we think this might be a nice thing to throw out there, but you have, your work is informed by the evidence, and that evidence comes from the people who make up your organization.
Yeah. You know, you talked about the anonymous way that you start and you're getting information. And to the whole deal about being an outsider, sometimes that's a good thing because people will open up when they haven't opened up to even their own manager. So somehow we lost Lauren. Let me see how I can do this. Lauren?
I'm here.
Okay, I don't know how we lost you.
Yeah, the call just dropped. I don't know why. Okay, you're back. I'm back.
Okay, so, but do I have both people on?
Yep, you do.
Okay. So what I was saying about sometimes it's good to be an outsider because you get information that maybe has not even been shared internally, even with your own supervisor. But there's a sense that for some people, they want you to beat up on the supervisor or the company or, you know, the department and give them a good whooping. But then there is, as you talked about the sustainability, there's got to be a way to not just air the newfound grievances that has been buried or embedded that's harming the culture, but it's also a way to say, okay, this is what we heard is happening. How can we address that? And trying to have some open and honest discussion about resolution in a way that's going to be managed and facilitated that maybe, you know, before you didn't have a person that you trusted enough to do that. So it's such important work, and I really appreciate you all's efforts and been doing this for a long time. In the few minutes that we have left, I do want to ask, how do you take care of your own mental health? Because you all are involved in so many different projects, and they're not just like hit and miss things. They are some time consuming, energy labor work. So how do you take care of yourselves?
I can start. Mine's a little bit of a funny answer, but when I was living in Boston, I knew that I'm a farm girl at heart, and I needed to move back to the farmland. So moving back to where I grew up and getting a farm, a small piece of property, and getting chickens and going on what my wife calls chicken walks at night has been really helpful for my mental health, which just means walking outside, being in the fresh air, seeing the green grass, and watching the chickens be silly and move around the property and just practice mindfulness in that moment. Mm-hmm. Just be there. Okay. Leave my phone in the house and take a break from all of those demands.
Okay. What about you, Stephanie?
That sounded so wonderful.
It did. Just sitting around doing nothing, watching the chickens. Yeah.
I take care of myself mostly by just being outdoors, taking walks, something I started doing during the lockdown and during the pandemic was taking all walks. I actually saw it written up. I think it was in the New York Times. They had a name for it. It was taking an all walk, which is a really simple thing. You can do it anywhere. You don't have to be in the country. You can be in the city. You could be anywhere, but just go outside, just get outside, get up from in front of the computer, go outside, And then just try to be in awe of something that's around you. Try to see something and appreciate something that you've never done before.
Yeah.
So that's one quick way. And I have another, like a little more, like an answer that's kind of more connected to the work, but it's the last thing I'll say because it's something that we really try to live by as we're doing the work. We really develop and promote this model of shared responsibility,
mm-hmm.
and that's been an important way of setting limits, especially where DE&I work is concerned. And within the organization, we sort of work with organizations to agree that the work belongs to everyone. It is not, you know, the DEI office or the chief DEIO to answer and hold all of this work. That's not sustainable, right?
Mm-hmm.
But to sort of promote, and we break that down, like what does shared responsibility look like, and make it really tangible so that every person in an organization, whatever they do, if they're answering the phones, if they're greeting folks at the door, if they're delivering food, everyone has a contribution to the work, to making, helping people to feel seen, heard, valued, and included. And it's everyone's job, not my job, not Lauren's job, but each person's job, every program, every division, every unit to figure out what is your role and how are we going to do that. And so it sounds like a kind of, in theory, like it could be something that's really up in the sky, but when you break it down into real practical terms, it's been fascinating to see what people can do,
mm-hmm.
and how they step into those roles in ways that we could never have predicted.
Wow.
And that sustains me.
Okay. Wow, well, we have had quite a discussion here. Thank you to Stephanie Pender Amaker and Lauren Wadsworth, and please continue that hard work that you are doing on the campuses with our young people. We appreciate it. I'm sure you don't hear that enough. And if you are missing any of the shows for Voices from the Battlefield, you can go to JamalaRogers.com and pick it up. This one will be up there in a couple of days. This is your host, and thank you for listening. I will see you on the battlefield.
Hello?